Hello, and welcome to a roundtable discussion on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo. In this episode, I'm joined by guests for a lively conversation on a topic we hope you'll find interesting. And we're back with another roundtable of the four guys. And here we have Chris Marshall from the Collected Comics podcast, John Mayo of the Comic Book Page podcast, and Andy Kunkka and myself from the Comics Alternative podcast. How's it going, guys?
Going well. How about you?
Great.
Doing okay. Doing okay. We're recording this on a Sunday, so as usual with Sundays, it's kind of a mix of wanting to relax, but not being able to because of work I have to do. But this recording is a nice little in-between, kind of a break from the grind.
Cool.
So one of the things that we decided to discuss last time we got together, remember last time we got together was in the wake of the Eisner Awards, right after the San Diego Con. We thought it'd be a good idea to discuss licensed comics because that topic, I can't even remember how that topic came up, but when it did,
I mentioned it in some kind of passing, but yeah.
Okay, yeah, and so Chris may have mentioned it, and then it resonated, and we thought, hey, why not? Let's use this as a topic for a future roundtable. So here we are. The four of us are together again talking about licensed comics. And maybe a great place to begin is defining what exactly we mean by licensed comics.
I guess for me, there's almost two variations. The true, real licensed comics, I think that everyone would kind of associate the term with, is when a publisher gets the rights to a property, a movie, TV, video game property, and then turns it into comics and stuff for licensed comics. So Star Wars, Star Trek, Doctor Who, The Bionic Man, G.I. Joe, Transformers, those are kind of the classic cases of that. I think there's a smaller kind of a subset or wherever where it's technically a licensed comic, but in some cases, it's like it's licensed from another publisher or something like that. The Mickey Mouse stuff that was done by Gladstone, Gemstone, and Boom is an example of that. The Red Circle characters from Archie that have been published by DC a time or two would be example of that. But something where somebody else owns the intellectual property rights than the company actually publishing the comics. Is that kind of the definition you guys would agree with, disagree with? What?
So like the Rocketeer and the Spirit comics would fit into that latter category when they're owned by the creator and another comic publisher publishes those.
Yeah, I would think so.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's interesting because I hadn't thought of the Spirit in terms of a licensed comic, but you know, most recently obviously it's IDW, but you know, then there was that Vertigo series, you know, DC, of course, with their archives. Yeah, but other people, you know, Kitchen Sink Press. Yeah.
And then there'd be that whole first wave thing that DC tried to do with Brian Azzarello that had the Spirit and who else? Doc Savage,
right.
The Avenger, all those pulp characters in addition to.
And a lot of those are the same sorts of characters currently being done over at, is it Dynamite or?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And we should also, and we probably will, say quite a bit about certain publishers that tend to do a lot, if not most, of their comic book publishing with licensed properties. Like you mentioned, Dynamite. I mean, they're a big one to do this. And IDW is another. And, Dark Horse with the Star Wars. Mm-hmm.
Boom at times also, yeah. I think licensed properties are a key part of the publishing plan for some publishers. And it's interesting because if I owned a property that was going to get licensed out, I would definitely have thoughts as to which publishers I would and would not want getting the rights to it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm liking a lot of what IDW and Dynamite are doing with their licensed properties and such, but sometimes I feel, and I guess more so IDW, Dynamite, both really, they get a license for something and they put too much material out too fast in too short of a time frame and almost like strip mine the property. You know, what they've done over at with Green Hornet, with the mm-hmm. Bionic Man franchise, and a few others, I don't feel it's necessarily in the best interests of the intellectual property, the way it's been kind of just, you know, churned out so quickly.
Yeah, so, John, that brings up a good point. I was going to say, John, you bring up a good point. Do you think that in some way that if I'm the owner of, or I'm the licensor of, like, G.I. Joe, right, and IDW or whoever, you know, ABC Comic Company is going to pick it up, do I, as a licensor, have any say on, you know, get a background information on who is going to be the writer and the artist of this before I hand it over? Because you want to make sure you've got a good creative team behind it, I would assume. And you don't run it, and the company doesn't run it into the ground.
I think that comes down to how well you get the contracts written. A smart license holder would say, yeah, I definitely want, you know, review rights on this. I want to have some say on who does and doesn't work on it. Things like that. Now, every time a license holder puts that into the contract, that's going to be one more thing the publisher is going to push back on and say, hey, wait, really? But I've seen a case or two where I think a license was squandered, but I've seen one or two, which is more applicable here, where I think the license was severely mishandled to the detriment of the property. And I'm thinking specifically Thundercats through Wildstorm a while back.
Mm.
They did some stuff there which really took a kid's cartoon property that had a very wholesome feel to it and put it into a much more adult, mature venue and stuff than I felt was appropriate. If I were the license holder, I would have been very unhappy with that situation. Now, whether the actual license holder was or not, don't know, don't care. But it comes down to how well the contracts are written.
Yeah, from what I understand, most license holders do have some kind of final approval over what goes out. And I know people who've listened to interviews with people who worked on G.I. Joe and its various manifestations, first at Marvel and now at IDW and through Devil's Due, I guess, have said that their work had to go through Hasbro before it could be published. And I don't know if that's standard operating procedure or not, but it would seem like it.
I've heard similar stories for Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure for Star Wars, but I'm not so sure about some of these others, like the Bionic Man franchise and such.
Mm-hmm.
If there's anyone who would really, on the license mm-hmm. holder end, really care.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know, like, I don't know if you all remember back to when this was a while ago when DC had announced that they'd gotten the license to Thunder Agents,
mm-hmm.
and they produced two issues of the series with, I think, Mark and Draco writing it, and the person who owned the Thunder Agents license just kept kind of interfering and rejecting it, and they finally just pulled the plug.
They wound up doing...
That was John Carbonaro, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
They wound up doing a 10-issue series and a 6-issue series of Thunder Agents.
Years later, John Carbonaro died. Yeah.
I
could see where that would change the situation a little. Yeah.
In fact, I was just about to ask. I mean, do you guys know of occasions, and apparently this is one, where the owner of the license is dissatisfied and in one way or another decides to pull something or just not cooperate anymore with the publisher?
It's funny you mentioned that because I knew John Carbonaro personally, and he was dissatisfied with everything. I mean, he was always, you know, lawsuit after lawsuit after lawsuit. I mean, he was involved in so much crap. It was just ridiculous. So, you know, I think, honestly, it pains me to say it. I mean, I didn't know him that well, but I know that after he passed away, it seems like the license got sorted out, and now IDW has it, and from what I am, you know, I'm happy with it, mm-hmm. what they're doing over there. And Chris Horrell and IDW is doing a great job. And I'm actually, I run the official board of Thunder Agents over at IDW.
Cool. There is one. I love the Thunder Agents. I get involved mm-hmm. in that. I like Nick Spencer's
run
a lot.
Yes, come on by. We need the input.
Yeah, Nick Spencer's done a good job with that property and such. I've heard over the years various Star Trek storylines would get started and then the people at Paramount would say, hey, you can't do that, and kind of pull the rug out from under things a couple of times. I think that was a source of at least periodic frustration for some of the writers.
But then, you know, Robert Horry is the start of it, yeah.
Well, and this is something that I've heard people speculating about over the past number of months since, Disney, bought, the Lucas material. And that is, what will happen to the Star Wars titles once Dark Horse's contract for the license runs out?
I don't think, you bring up a good point. From what I understand, it's not going to run out. From what I've seen, I think Dark Horse is gonna keep on producing what they're producing because Lucas is very happy with it, and they've had a great relationship for over 20 years. So there really isn't any reason to end their contract.
Well, I think it comes down to when does the contract get renewed, which is at least 8 months out or something, and what happens then. And if it does go away from Dark Horse, I hope it winds up being a better situation than what happened with the Mickey Mouse franchise of characters, which got pulled from Boom and really hasn't resurfaced over at Marvel.
Well, and John, you know that the guys who run the Dark Horse Star Wars, they've been doing it for years.
Yeah.
And they've been doing a very good job. And if you know what? If we were to go to Marvel, I would hope those creators and writers would go to Marvel too, because they have a handle on the property.
I don't see any advantage for anybody to move the Star Wars stuff out of Dark Horse and over to Marvel.
Right.
Marvel, I think,
that's
has,
what I'm saying.
Yeah, I think they've got a questionable track record on licensed material. They did great back in the 70s. They did all right in the 80s. But then you look at some of the stuff they did more recently in the 90s and stuff with Star Trek and whatnot when they had the Paramount license. It just wasn't that great. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, could they do great stuff with Star Wars? Certainly over at Marvel. No question about that. But will they is the bigger question.
You mentioned Star Wars in the 70s. I am sure that I picked up more than one issue of Star Wars comics from Marvel when I was a kid growing up in the 70s. I don't remember it, and I don't have those old comics anymore, unfortunately, so I couldn't, attest to the fact that I did or didn't. I don't remember anything about them, so maybe that should say something. Either I did not get any issues, or they just didn't resonate with me. And I was a big Star Wars fan.
I love those comics. I was into them. I had a subscription to them. I probably was reading them well before I got into see Star Wars, before it came to the little town theater and the place I lived in North Dakota. So that was my first exposure to Star Wars.
Really? The comic before the film?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
And even into the post, the first six issues were the adaptation of the first movie. Even after that, the stuff that followed. The stuff that, by the way, Roy Thomas tells a really funny story about that, because he was writing it at the time, and there's that second arc that has Han Solo and Chewbacca recruiting a gang of bounty hunters for another mission, and one of them is a giant green rabbit named Jackson.
That's
something
right,
like that.
Jax, yeah.
And he won't, Lucas hated that, and Roy claims that that's the impetus for Lucas to take a heavier hand in the Star Wars licensed properties from then on.
Okay, so he didn't. So you say this is a large green rabbit thing?
Yeah.
Okay.
Smart aleck green rabbit.
Okay, so he didn't like that, but then years later he gave his Jar Jar Bing.
Yeah, well, no accounting for taste.
Well, it's interesting because if you go back to kind of that era of Marvel, they did a lot of, not a lot, but enough licensed stuff. Not only Star Wars, they did Godzilla, later again G.I. Joe, Transformers, and they were very successful with that stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's a company that has a huge intellectual property library of their own to be milking. So to go grab somebody else's property and do it, I always find that kind of interesting. It's not like they were for a loss of material to print.
Yeah, and in order to do Star Wars, they were taking a chance because they had to get that series into production well before the movie hit theaters, and nobody was anticipating, what it would be, how huge it would be.
Mm-hmm. I think they may have just been going off the fact it was going to have toys and things like that. Because really, a lot of licensed properties around
Transformers,
the 70s and 80s. Well, I mean, even Power Lords and a few other toy lines that went nowhere had comic book tie-ins for a bit.
Wasn't there some kind of... I remember, that reminds me of, what is it, the Marvel series, I don't know if it was more than an issue, of Crystar, that was also a toy line. I seem to remember there being kind of greater synergy between Marvel and the toy company that owned it in terms of having it developed, you know, having the comic developed almost before getting the toys going. And I know that reminds me, I know that Larry Hama wrote all of the cards on the back of the early G.I. Joe comics and created those characters himself. So that there was synergy there, too.
No, it makes sense. If you've got, you know, creative people doing the comics and stuff, why not tie them in as much as practical with the creation of the toys? Because then you can get a kind of a virtual cycle upswing or whatever of everything. It always frustrates me when something gets licensed for an ongoing active property, and they're clearly not really totally in sync with what's going on with the property, be it in TV or movie form. And sometimes things just either don't jive or flat out fly in the face of what's going on. You know, it happens, it's understandable, it's a natural thing, but it, as a reader, it gets a little frustrating.
Mm-hmm.
Well, for you guys, what are some instances of licensed comics that have just fallen much lower in terms of expectations than you would have thought?
Well, for me, the go-to example has got to be the Stargate franchise that I guess it was IDW did for a while. And Stargate at the time was really popular. It had already had not just the SG-1 TV show. It had Atlantis. It was before Universe, I think, when they had the property. And they did all of, I think, two miniseries, one focusing on Daniel Jackson, the other on Vala Maldoran. But at the time, it was one of the premier, you know, sci-fi properties on TV, and they did next to nothing with it.
So was it a matter of the publisher just not being as aggressive in getting the material and marketing the material, a problem of the content that just wasn't catching on, or what?
I'm suspecting, and I am wildly speculating here, that it was a matter of something between the publisher and the content holder, because initially they seemed to indicate they were going to do a one-shot that was promoting, you know, three or four different ongoing titles they were going to do. And I mean, this was Dynamite, so it was going to be kind of like how they milk any property very aggressively, and then that didn't pan out. So I'm wondering if they just couldn't get story approval or something like that. I have no idea, but it was very disappointing.
Because one of the reasons why I ask this is because of something that came up in one of our previous discussions, and this is probably what eventually led to Chris mentioning something about licensed property being a good topic, and then us talking about it today. And that is the fact that there are some titles currently that you would think would sell a lot better than they do, given the fan base for the larger franchise, you know, film, television, what have you. But yet the comics really aren't selling that well compared to what they could.
I've talked about that a few times on the Mayo Report and stuff, specifically Doctor Who and Star Trek, and how they're getting trounced in comic book sales by, like, My Little Pony. And nothing against My Little Pony. Again, another licensed property. It's got a huge fan base that's been well mobilized into the comic arena. But, you know, Star Trek not only has this huge television history, it's been revitalized very well in movie format again with the reboot. Doctor Who, 50th anniversary and such. And those things are selling in the 10 to 15,000 range in the comic side. They've got a bigger audience than that.
Okay, and what recently has My Little Pony been doing monthly?
Let me check real quick. It started, I think, around, what, 80,000 or something, yeah. Give me just a second. I will pull that up.
Okay. Because, you know, I'm just wondering, what is it that the people involved in My Little Pony are doing that is different from what we find going on with, let's say, Star Trek or Doctor Who. Now, you know, Star Trek and Doctor Who have the same publisher as My Little Pony. So, you know, is IDW doing something different in some way with one than the other title? Or is it just the very content of My Little Pony is something, because maybe it's all age, it's going to be something overtly all age, it's something that's going to resonate with a wider audience. I don't know.
The total sales of the first issue of My Little Pony, Friendship is Magic, which has an ongoing cartoon, I believe, to go with it, around 95,000. Second issue dropped to around 40,000, and it's been fluctuating a little above, a little below, between 30 and 50,000 ever since. And then there's another series, the micro series, that's a bunch of one-shots that's doing around the 25,000 mark. Let me add in to this chart real quick. Star Trek. And then see how that's doing for the ongoing. The Star Trek ongoing.
Well, I know that Chris Ryle, while you're looking it up, John, I know that Chris Ryle came out and said that My Little Pony collectively has sold over 1 million copies of the property so far. And that was just a few weeks ago.
The Star Trek ongoing started around 16,000, has gone right around the 10,000 mark, and has kind of bounced up just ever so slightly to around the 11,000 mark. So it didn't start anywhere near as strong, and this is all based on the movie and such, and yeah, it's surprising to me.
I was wondering,
they might get a little bump coming up with the Khan series coming out, I hope, but you know, again, that's just an origin gimmick story.
Yeah, I wonder if there's, I don't know how fully fleshed out this idea is, and you know, I know Doctor Who has had success with novels, with prose novels, so this may not hold up, but I'm just wondering if the fans of Star Trek and Doctor Who have exactly enough Star Trek and Doctor Who from television or from movies that they need, and they don't want more, whereas the market for My Little Pony or Adventure Time or any of those things are more demanding of further stories and adventures of the characters they like.
That's a good question, because I can definitely say that with My Little Pony. Now, not being a brony and really not knowing much of anything about the history of My Little Pony, I would guess that there just hasn't been a lot out there over the past several years for My Little Pony fans to really take to. And then, you know, relatively recently we had this new title come up. And so, you know, given what you're saying, Andy, it just makes sense that a lot of My Little Pony fans, older, younger, male and female, would gravitate and then gobble up, you know, the My Little Pony comic books. You know, maybe not the same thing with Adventure Time. I mean, that's I'm glad you brought that up as well. Another licensed example. I mean, this is something that has been around for a while. And so the cartoon is out there for people to enjoy. So at least it had more recent contemporary exposure than My Little Pony. But yet we still find fairly high sales with Adventure Time, I guess, right?
I just pulled up the sales of Adventure Time, and it's been doing around 20,000. It got as high as 27,000, and has recently just dipped below down to around 19,000.
Huh.
So it's still doing significantly better, like almost 10,000 units better at times than Star Trek.
Right.
But again, you know, I think My Little Pony, it's got a longer track. It's been around longer, but not as a comic, and therefore, I guess you could argue the pent-up demand for the comic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I wonder how, like, I wonder what the demographics of My Little Pony break down, and there's, you know, maybe there are, you know, 50,000 bronies out there, and they're the ones who are buying this. But I think it's I don't think that there's, you know, just from, you know, my experience with talking to fans and having, you know, students whose kids are into My Little Pony as well, the kind of past existence of My Little Pony has very little to do with anybody's interest in that property today. The new, whatever the new series is, Friendship is Magic, is, you know, a kind of complete re-envisioning of My Little Pony. So anybody who had, you know, any kids who are getting into it probably have little understanding of that. Of that history, you know, maybe their parents did, but I think for all intents and purposes, it's a new property to most fans, I would guess.
Fair enough. Would you say there's a greater intensity of the fandom than there is maybe for some of these other properties? I mean, I think there's a ton of Star Trek fans, but I don't know if they are as rabid or, you know, passionate about it as, say, compared to Adventure Time or My Little Pony, typical fan might be.
Yeah, I'm just speculating here, but I would say that may be true. And on top of that, maybe better networked so that word of mouth about the quality of the comics spreads through those fans a little quicker than fans of those other properties.
See, now this is interesting, the whole, I guess, word of mouth phenomena, and because I would guess, and again, I'm speculating as well, but I would guess that Doctor Who fans would be more rabid when it came to more and different Doctor Who narratives. You know, now maybe Andy's right, maybe we can call this the Kunkka thesis. You know, I mean, maybe there is this kind of saturation point that, you know, if fans are saying, okay, well, I have my Doctor Who fix, you know, if Doctor Who's not on, I can watch past issues of Torchwood, so on and so forth. I don't need the comic. I mean, there may be that as well, but I don't know. I would just think that as enthusiastic as many Doctor Who fans are of the people I've encountered, that they would be, you know, very amenable to picking up a title. But then this raises the question. I mean, how many fans of Doctor Who, and we could say the same thing with Star Trek, you know, how many of these fans may not even know that a comic book exists on this property?
Well, I mean, historically, I think the crossover between comic fans and sci-fi fans, fans of Star Trek and Doctor Who, I think there's a high crossover there. So to claim they may not be aware, I mean, certainly some fans aren't going to be aware, but the fact that these properties are, you know, very much targeted towards the same demographic already going into comic shops indicate, and other comics are selling well above them, you know, indicates to me that there's some disconnect there. I think a lot of it comes down to, by and large, those comics are not in continuity. They don't matter.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's less of a truism for the Star Trek ongoing. I think it very much is in continuity. Although I'd be hard-pressed to name any plot point that happened in the comic that got referenced in the movie, but we've had one movie for them to do that in so far. But I think that's part of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that makes sense, then, the My Little Pony stuff and the Adventure Time stuff, too. The continuity is fairly irrelevant for those fans, I would guess. So, you know, someone going into a Doctor Who comic or a Star Trek comic would already know in advance that the stakes are very, very low in that story.
Mm. Now, excuse my ignorance of My Little Pony, but is there currently, outside of the comics, any kind of My Little Pony narrative going on right now? Is there something on television I'm not aware of?
I believe there's a cartoon called My Little Pony Friendship is Magic.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, what I don't know is if it's a serial narrative or episodic.
Right.
I'm okay. Assuming episodic.
And how long has this been going on?
That I couldn't tell you.
I don't know.
Okay. Andy, did you say?
Yeah, it's like a couple of years.
Okay, so longer than...
Probably a couple of years, yeah.
So longer than... Well, the reason I was asking is I was trying to look for, again, some kind of sense as to why one is selling in a way that the other is not, or catching on and with fans is the other isn't. And you know, given what we've been discussing, with Doctor Who and Star Trek, there seems to be... It would seem to me that the dominant narrative, and that would be either the television shows or the films, okay, would be what any fan would defer to. So whatever comic you find with Doctor Who, you know, any Doctor Who related title or any Star Trek related title, is going to take a back seat and is going to be judged against the dominant narrative of that franchise. And of course, that's going to be the television and or film, right? But with My Little Pony and Adventure Time, it's maybe the episodic nature is a part of this, as you guys are mentioning.
I think the animated aspect is part of it too, because I think with like Doctor Who, you've got Matt Smith, David Tennant, Chris Eccleston, you've got some very charismatic actors as the lead. You've got a lot of really good action sequences. It's much more thrilling and exciting to watch the TV show. And even if it were brilliantly executed, a comic's going to have a hard time measuring up to that.
Mm-hmm. You know, and also what you just said about the animation aspect, you know, in going from television or film to comic form, there's going to be a much easier, smoother, and sensible transition visually, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the characters we get, the ponies we get in My Little Pony comic, are going to look like the exact same ponies on the television program, whereas a comics illustrated version of Matt Smith is going to resemble the real-life Matt Smith that we see on the Doctor Who television show, but it's just there's going to be significant differences. You have an iconic Jeff Smith instead of the actual Jeff Smith. And so the transition, visually speaking, going from one medium to the other is a little more abrupt.
You know, it's interesting you mention that, because while I don't have sales information in front of me for it, at one point, and I forget which publisher it was that did this, they did Power Ranger Ninja Storm graphic novels using stills from the show. And just put word balloons in front of them. Hmm. Now, the travesty of that execution was not only was this more in a digest size, but the screen captures or whatever were like literally postage stamp size. They were microscopic. But it was one of those where, again, it looked literally just like the TV show, because that's what it was from. But it never really caught on. I think they did three, maybe four of them for Ninja Storm, and I don't know if they did them for any other series after that.
Well, do you all remember the
IDW is going to do that with Star Trek coming up?
Yeah, oh. Yeah. Well, there were the Star Trek photo novels in the 70s.
Well,
that
and
did the same thing that were at yeah. that are adaptations of TV episodes, just straight up.
John Byrne's going to do one where he's cobbled stuff together from various photos, and it'll be a new story.
Huh.
Oh, that'll be cool.
I'm looking forward to that. That sounds very, very interesting.
So it's like a Fumati.
Is that what they're going to do with Star Trek then, John?
Yeah, that's that. Burns doing, I think, one shot that
way. I thought he was just going to do the word balloons from the old episodes.
No.
Oh, that'll be cool if they do something new.
Yeah, my understanding is it's a brand new story, and it's going to be like a TV episode on paper, literally.
Oh, cool.
And Burns a huge Star Trek fan, so I think it'll be pretty good.
Well, I haven't even read his run on Star Trek.
He did a number of miniseries for IDW,
mm-hmm.
And he really gets the classic series really well.
And hasn't that just recently, like within the past several months, been collected into this nice hardbound edition? Or am I mistaken?
I'll defer to Chris on that.
They collected it a while ago, yeah, for something like that. Yeah, it's been out for a while.
Okay.
John Byrne collection, yeah. I think there's a softcover one, too. It was like one of their best of ones they did a couple of years ago, and they may have reissued it recently.
I just remember seeing it in my shop at some point over the summer and thinking, oh, okay, that would be good at some point to get. Because I love Star Trek, I love John Byrne, so it's kind of like, you know, Reese's, right? You got peanut butter in my chocolate.
Exactly.
Yeah, you
exactly.
can't go wrong. Yeah.
It's interesting, though, because when you take an hour-long show and try to adapt it into a comic book, the 22-page format doesn't work as well, because the stories are typically that you're used to in the comic or the live-action show or whatever, the hour-long show, are longer. You can't do them really fulfillingly in a done-in-one issue, and if you do them over the span of, you know, the five or six issues it would really take to do them justice, it feels like you're only getting a sliver of a story per installment. Both ways wind up feeling at times very unsatisfying.
Well, in light of that, let me ask you, which one of you guys or who has been reading, because I have not, the MacGyver comic?
I read that. Yeah, I was very excited about that when that came out. I thought they captured the tone and the style and the voice of the show very well. But given that the creator of the show was heavily involved in the comic, I was not the least bit surprised.
Okay. Did the rhythm of the stories, you know, segments contained within a single issue of a comic book, did that work well, almost like a single episode of the television program?
I would say the miniseries itself was akin to a single episode.
Okay, and then how many issues were in the mini?
Five.
Oh, okay.
But it was a little while since I read it when it came out. But it was.
You get commercial breaks with the comics.
Yeah. Yeah. Longer bathroom breaks.
Yes. Pretty much. Yeah. Month long. But it was good because, I mean, they weren't trying to capture Richard Dean Anderson's features, but they were trying to get a character that looked like MacGyver.
Now, John, let me ask you, was that a sequel to the TV show, or did it take place within the TV show? Like, was it, like, what year, or was it, like, because didn't they, at the end of this show, like, they had this kid finally revealed, and they revealed his name and everything?
They did, but that kid wasn't seen in the two TV movies done afterwards.
Okay.
This, the comic was neither an adaptation, continuation, nor a reboot. It was as if it were during the TV series, but modern day. But I think in one or two minor places, it was out of continuity in terms of certain things they said in the comic didn't jive with what happened at times in the show. But frankly, during the show, they had those sort of continuity glitches at times, too.
Okay.
Yes, I'm a MacGyver fan.
Well, what you just asked a moment, Chris, about, you know, is it basically a continuation from that? I mean, that adds another level of, I don't know, inquiry, discussion when it comes to licensed comics. And that is those titles that have basically picked up where another medium, such as television, has left off. And a great example of that is Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Now, I do have to admit, you know, I've really not watched any episodes of the television program, haven't read any issues of the comic, but I have friends who were almost rabid Buffy fans, and when they discovered that a comic was basically going to be picking up where the series left off, they gobbled it up.
Mm-hmm. It was
yeah,
good
John
stuff.
Can speak more to Buffy than I can, yeah.
Yeah, I've watched all the TV show. I read season 8. I think I bowed out for season 9. They were taking advantage of a essentially unlimited special effects budget. And while they were telling really good stuff, the nature of the stories was different in tone and style at times, although they got the voice and stuff right for the characters. It was kind of weird. That was one that when it launched, I mean, some of the early stuff was up in the 100,000 plus range when you look at the reorders factored in and whatnot. But then, man, it just kept sliding in sales. By the time season 9 kicked in, it was under 40,000, and then it's trailed off down to around 20,000. So while it's continued the story, it hasn't continued the momentum.
Now, you bring it. That's a very interesting analogy you just brought up with Buffy, because John and I have talked at length over the past couple of years, how you have Buffy with Dark Horse, right? Dark Horse. And then you've got Spike and Angel with IDW. And that was a very interesting dynamic, how the characters, even though they're in the same universe, could not cross over with each other because of the licensed properties.
You know, that's interesting because I think that's something we've seen over the last few years as a fundamental shift in the way properties are getting licensed. And I think that's both into comics and out of comics into other areas. It used to be that you licensed a very particular segment of the universe. Batman, Superman, or Angel versus Buffy or something. Now the licensing seems to be more universal, if you will, where we're able to get characters cross, you know, both Angel and Buffy into the same area or whatever. We're able to get other characters than just Green Arrow characters in the Arrow TV show. And kind of that bigger canvas there in the concept of a Marvel universe in the films, in the S.H.I.E.L.D. TV show, and that nature. To me, it seems to be a fundamental shift in the scope of the licensing deals, or the nature of them.
Yeah, I was thinking about that in relationship to some of the stuff Dynamite's been doing lately, too, with, like, the Mask series and Codename Action and King's Watch to a lesser degree, since all the characters in King's Watch are licensed from the same source, but those other two require, and first, I guess DC's first wave was like this too, require kind of multiple licensees, properties being brought together.
I'm not so sure about that, because some of the stuff with the masks, less with the masks, I guess I'm thinking more Project Superpowers and the Codename Action stuff,
mm-hmm.
those seem to be more public domain characters.
Mm.
Because some of those are showing up also over on Tom Strong and the Planet Apparel or whatever.
Right.
Wildstorm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So all those, what was it? What's the name of the publisher? I can't remember the name of the original. Standard. Yeah, Standard Comics. All those characters are definitely in the public domain. But like Peter Cannon Thunderbolt is actually owned by, what's his name? Pete Marici, the guy who created it for Charlton. And then there's, what is it? In Masks, you have Green Hornet teaming up with the Shadow and stuff like that.
And Zorro and a few others, yeah.
Yeah, and Zorro, yeah. All of whom I believe are still, are not in the public domain, right?
I'm pretty sure that's the case, but I'm not positive. It's hard to tell sometimes as to which characters where. So it is interesting that they are doing kind of that universe building there, and I think that's Dynamite's approach of trying to get a de facto superhero universe of sorts mm-hmm. going, or more pulp universe going.
I like that better than what they were doing before, where, as you talked about earlier, with Green Hornet, where there were, you know, how many... 8 Green Hornet series or whatever and Kato series going on all at once, and they did really seem to be trying to have some kind of race to cash in on the license and the film and so on, whereas I feel like especially with King's Watch, there is a universe building going on, and we're kind of getting Flash Gordon's origin, in which the Phantom and Mandrake the Magician are also involved. And that seems to be a slower build than giving us 8 Green Hornet series, though we are getting, I don't know how many Shadow series right now.
Well, and then look at the approach they're going to take to Doc Savage, where it's an 8-issue series covering his entire career in a series of one-shots.
Yeah.
I think Dynamite has learned.
Good luck with that.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how it does. I'm looking forward to it myself. Chris Roberson's mm-hmm. a great writer. I think
Dynamite, well, hopefully it's going to do better than First Wave.
Yeah. I think any time you got a property that's licensed in by Marvel and DC, particularly with DC, it falls into the neither fish nor fowl category.
Yeah,
it's not part of their universe, but it's not completely not superhero stuff. So people who might have wanted a Doc Savage thing probably weren't going for that because, well, it's tying into Batman and other stuff. It's like, really, what's going on here?
Well, that's just the key. I mean, just because you've got a great writer, who was we touched on, it was Azzarello, right?
Yeah.
Just because you have Azzarello and you throw Batman in there doesn't mean you're going to get a hit. And that proved it. You know, nobody knew what the hell was going on with this. And that was during they were kind of revamping everything with the Crisis. And then Lauren of the Jungle Girl shows up, and then the Spirit shows up. I thought it was a complete mess. I read it all. You know, the only good thing that came out of it was the first issue that was the Batman Spirit crossover. And then they did First Wave, and then it all went to hell.
It was Batman Doc Savage for this special, wasn't it?
They did Batman Spirit.
Oh, okay.
No, the Batman Spirit was set Spirit up. One. Batman Spirit set up Darwin Cook's Spirit series.
Was that Darwin Cook's? All right.
That preceded that.
Well, that was pretty good.
Yeah, and then the Batman Doc Savage thing was by Azzarello and Phil Noto, and that was probably the highlight of that set of stories anyway.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because the whole point of going with a licensed property is you've got a known quantity, you've got, in theory, a built-in audience. You mm-hmm. should have more predictable sales just going into it, and it seems like often they don't.
I wonder
it's
how
like
many...
we're living that right now with Rocketeer in Spirit, then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just wonder how many built-in Doc Savage fans there are. know, like what might that number be?
Well, you bring up an interesting question there, or a way to split properties between those that are active and those that are effectively dormant. And it's like, are there really any fans right now? I would put MacGyver into that category. The comic came out, 10, 15, 20 years after the show ended. They're also, I think they're straight to digital right now, but they're currently comics being done for Airwolf and Knight Rider. How big of an audience is there for that? I don't know. I'm curious.
We need a Rockford File comic.
Yeah. Oh, wow. I'd be all over that. Especially if like Rucka wrote it. But that's part of the deal too, is like with, you know, you mentioned Chris Roberson with Doc Savage. I mean, he's, you know, I'm an okay Doc Savage fan, but I'm going to get that series because of him. And I've been reading, you know, Masks and his Shadow and stuff because it's him writing that, or I got into the new Shadow series because Garth Ennis was writing it. So, you know, that, you know, as long as there's these companies are putting decent creators on their properties, there may be a better chance of them catching on. And I think Dynamite's sort of learning that lesson. And putting Steve Niles on the Army of Darkness series, for example, I think is a good idea.
Well, I think Dynamite's had a lot of opportunities to learn that lesson.
Yeah.
Because some of the stuff they've come out with the licensed properties, frankly, I'm surprised some of it's still coming out. I'm thinking specifically the Bionic Man franchise. Aaron Gillespie's writing it. I have no idea who he is and what else he's done. And, you know, it's entertaining and stuff, but again, it's very different from the TV show, and I'm not sure who they've aimed the comic at.
Yep.
Well, that's one of those problems with older programs and characters, right? Is, you know, there are going to be some like us who may gravitate to the title out of nostalgia, or at least initially. I mean, it could be, you know, a case where, you know, like Andy mentioned, you know, a creator that you particularly like is doing that, so you're going to pick it up and read it. But, you know, others say, oh, like, for instance, if there were, you know, if a nobody, you know, out of nowhere did a Rockford Files series or miniseries, I'm like Andy, I'd be all over that. Just, you know, initially out of curiosity and, you know, because this was a program that I loved watching as a kid. But it's not going to resonate with those younger than we are, definitely not with my son, or even people older, you know, like a decade older than him. He's like, Rockford, who?
Well, there comes a point with that audience where it's got to stand on its own merits, at which point, what's the advantage of it being a licensed property versus something new?
Yeah, exactly. Right. And then it has to make the case for itself, you know, so for, you know, I mean, why a new Rockford Files series, or in the case of something that actually did happen, you know, why a new MacGyver?
Yeah.
Well, and John, you bring up a good point too, because if you take something like Stargate, and, you know, God forbid, a company like Dynamite gets the license, they run it into the ground, and if you're the license holder, you're going to think twice about licensing it out again for another comic series.
Yeah, yeah. Which is a shame, because,
you know, on the flip side, now if you are the license holder, what are you going to do with Stargate? You know, it's just going to sit there and go dormant again for another 10 years.
Yeah, so I was going to say there's some properties that nothing else is happening with them anyways. I mean, at one point I thought about going into publishing, and there were a couple of properties that I was thinking about licensing if I could get the rights to them. And I think MacGyver was one of them. Of course, it was much closer to the TV series coming out. And ending. I think The Bionic Man was one of them. There were one or two out of some novels that I really enjoyed. And it basically came down to, what did I find really entertaining, really enjoyable, that I think could translate well to the comic book medium and get a new audience there?
Yeah, you know, that question, I think of that question all the time when I'm looking at back issues of ROM Space Knight from Marvel. I mean, there was a property that had no legs to begin with, right? That toy is one of the most ridiculous, worthless toys that was ever made, and it really is only the comic book that gives it any kind of vibrancy. And I don't. There's some kind of tangled mess over who owns ROM. I think one of the designers still owns a piece of it, and apparently nobody can get together enough to put out, you know, for Marvel to at least put out, you know, ROM essentials, or you know, include in the Marvel 2-in-1 essential book the issue thing in ROM trade. Yeah, that and so there's, you know, what I that boggles my mind that nobody is saying, no, you know, the people who have this property in hands, and again, there may be other reasons that I don't know about it, aren't just saying, okay, well, we can make some money on this. It's not like holding on to it is going to be, or holding on to it for a better deal.
Yeah. Well, sometimes it comes down to who would you go ask to buy the rights from? You know, I think at times that's more convoluted than it needs to be. And I think in that sort of situation, were somebody to say, gosh, I just love ROM, I want to do a new comic with that, I would urge them to do a rent-to-own model on the licensing. You know, because like you said, it's otherwise not doing the license holder any good. Now, what's interesting is Marvel has done a follow-up miniseries or two with the Space Knights.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which is one of the couple of cases where they've taken the original characters they created during those runs that they have the rights to and kept going with them. I think they also did that with Micronauts.
Yeah. Yeah, and Hickman just killed... just destroyed Galador in the Infinity series too. So,
He destroyed it.
Yeah, the Space Knights have been around.
Oh, interesting.
And so there.
Spoilers!
There
was, I'm not caught up on Infinity.
It's the first two pages of the first issue.
Oh, so, was it? Yeah. I must have glossed over that one.
They should have put a caption. The Space Knights used to live here. No.
and there was that there were a couple of miniseries for to go along with the Hulk that had the Micronauts characters in them. And so pretty much all of the Micronauts characters, with the exceptions of the robots and a courier, are, you know, Marvel characters. And so those come back all the time. So you could technically still do a Micronauts series and only miss a few characters.
You know, as you guys have been talking, I've looked this up because, you know, Micronauts, ROM, they completely were absent from my awareness when I was growing up. But both of those titles with Marvel started in 1979.
Mm-hmm. Again, that was a really good time for licensed properties with Marvel, because it was around that time, give or take a few years, that they also had, again, Transformers, Star Wars, G.I. Joe...
Shogun Warriors,
yeah.
Godzilla.
Godzilla, yeah. A ton of great stuff. Now, it's interesting because that was also around the time that Marvel had a deal with the Toei company over in Japan, which is what led to the Japanese Spider-Man show. And again, that's not a licensed comic, but a thing licensed from comics. And that was also what essentially revived the Sentai shows into the Super Sentai shows, which years later led into Power Rangers, which has been currently adapted into some graphic novels.
Wow.
I always find it interesting when properties kind of go in one direction and then kind of circle back. We've got Green Arrow, who's been adapted into the TV show, which has been adapted into the Arrow digital and then print comic and such. Mm-hmm. So it's going full circle. But I still think the one that takes the cake there is, I think it's Hellboy. It went from comic to movie to animated feature after that, adapted to comic and then turned back. I forget how it goes. It circled around at least twice, I think, at one point. But I'm not a Hellboy fan, so I couldn't tell you all the details off the top of my head. It's just
you say Hellboy started how, did you say?
As a comic.
Oh, okay. I missed that.
Turned into a movie.
Right. Mm-hmm.
There was an animated, I guess, feature comics or cartoon series or something off it that was adapted into a comic and then back into a feature or some such. It was weird.
Okay. I missed that first part when you said started off as a comic. And then for some reason I thought, what, did he just miss out on the origins of Hellboy?
No, not at all.
Me mislistening.
That's okay.
Well, I think with the animated series, though, I mean, the guys who did the movies, was it Legendary? They were in on the cartoon, because Ron Perlman did the voice for Hellboy in the cartoon.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and Mignola's got that. He's still got a thumb on his property, too.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Smart owners hang on to some of the rights there if they can.
Very smart.
Again, that comes down to your earlier question of, you know, what rights does the license holder have? And it comes down to whatever they were smart enough to work out. I still think one of the more hilarious ones in terms of circling back on things, and this is more or less completely out of comics, is the Super Sentai shows get adapted to Power Rangers. The Power Rangers get retranslated back into Japanese because it's a different enough show. And the people who were the actors for the original show being adapted tend to do the voices for the Americanized version. It's quite bizarre.
Well, you know, what you're saying right now reminds me of kind of a side topic, and I don't suggest that we ought to go in this direction, but it's something that one could easily spin off of the topic of licensed comic, and that is this whole issue of adaptation, because this is just what we're discussing today is just another example of, or a kind of adaptation at work.
Well, it's interesting there because it used to be that comics that were based on TV show and films, mainly films, were literally adaptations of them because we didn't have VCRs and DVDs back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's just continuations in that universe. Yet Marvel, with their properties that have turned into movies, are doing comic adaptations of the movies, which I find kind of interesting.
One of my favorite manifestations of this phenomenon is the Masters of the Universe toys came with comics originally, and then there were comic series related to those, and then there was the movie, which is basically a recycled New Gods adaptation. And then coming back now to comics, where Keith Giffen is basically doing a recycled New Gods story in the Masters of the Universe comic.
Interesting.
And by the way, I don't know if you've ever seen the Masters of the Universe movie with Dolph Lundgren. It's it's terrible until you watch it through the lens of Jack Kirby, and then you realize somebody knows what they're doing.
I never made that connection to the New Gods stuff.
and the writer has claimed that that's true.
Hey, if it works, you know, makes the material look that much better, why not go with it? Yeah.
You know, another kind of licensed comic is something that, unless I'm forgetting something, I don't think we see much of anymore, and that is not so much the licensing of a title in terms of like a series or a film. I mean, you know, since the beginning of comics, we've had versions of that, right? So, you know, classic 1950s television programs have had their versions of comics, you know, the Honeymooners whatnot. Yeah. But I'm talking about not just a program, but let's say a personality. And I'm thinking here in particular of not only Bob Hope comics.
Bob Hope, Jerry Lewis, yeah.
But yeah, I was going to say something that Andy and I never seem to tire of discussing, and that is Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis things. And, you know, first the Dean Martin, Jerry Lewis comic, and then the Jerry Lewis comic. And so those are centered around, I mean, it's not centered around, you know, not your show of shows, but the Colgate Comedy Hour. Was that the Jerry Lewis? Indeed, was that the show that they were on? Yeah, Colgate. So you don't have a comic devoted to that, which would be kind of strange, but you have it on the figures, the personalities of Martin and Lewis, or with Bob Hope, you know, not based on a Bob Hope movie or any kind of television special, but the personality of Bob Hope. That's another kind of licensing, because I don't really know any detail about this, but, you know, celebrities do have a say in, you know, how they appear and whatnot. So that's another form of licensing. And we don't see that much today, do we? I mean, as far as I know, there's nothing like a Justin Bieber comic, is there?
Well, there are those Adam West and...
the Adam West
stuff from Blue Water. Comics from Blue Water.
Okay, so outside of Blue... Okay, good point. I didn't think about the Blue Water. There's probably a reason for that, but
they're no longer of printing. I think they're going mainly digital these days, or at least they're no longer through Diamond, I should say. I've lost track of what their current status is.
Yeah.
I was thinking within the last 10, maybe 20 years, so maybe not the today category you were looking for, there was either a Chuck Norris thing, a Mr. T thing.
Mr. T, yeah.
And I know, and this is going back more towards the 90s, so again, not current day, Jackie Chan.
And along with that, I'm thinking of other kinds of entertainment personalities like the Beatles and the Monkees. I was going through my hard drive looking for something the other day, and I came across something I'd forgotten that I'd saved. I'd come across a couple of digital issues of old Monkees comics, And I, you know, I'm a big Monkees fan, and I thought, huh, that's right. There was a comic based on the Monkees, just as there were on, you know, other kind of pop groups.
Would you say that was based on the group or the show?
Okay, now that's interesting with the Monkees. Now, with the Beatles, obviously, it's the personality, right? The group.
Yeah, it's definitely the group.
But see, the Monkees television show is the Monkees personality because they were created on the show specifically as personalities based on the Beatles. And so I think trying to ferret out, you know, which is prominent, the personality or the television program, in the case of the Monkees, I'd just say they're one and the same.
Yeah, so I would lean towards it being just an adaptation of the show versus the group.
Yeah, but definitely with the Monkees, you have that is kind of like the, you know, the Bob Hope and Jerry Lewis example. They're based on the personalities.
That's interesting. Because there was, you know, there was the what was it, Charlton maybe had the Partridge Family comic.
Yeah,
spun off a David Cassidy comic in which David Cassidy's playing is, you know, David Cassidy in the comic, but the Partridge Family is the Partridge Family.
I'm really surprised we don't see more of that sort of stuff these days, particularly based on the number of Disney TV shows that they could, for lack of a better term, crank out comic book versions or adaptations of through Marvel or some other imprint.
Right. Now, I mean, you won't find it now, obviously, but, you know, a number of years ago, maybe there was, and I just don't know about it, a comic based on Hannah Montana.
I don't know. I don't recall
any
comics. There might have been some periodic graphic novels.
My daughter's got those.
There were Hannah Montana comics?
Yeah.
Really? Huh. See, now if they came out with Miley Cyrus comics.
My daughter had those.
Okay. Yeah. If they came out with Miley Cyrus comics now, I think some publisher like a Zenoscope would have to do that.
Could be.
There you go.
Yeah, put Miley in the.
But they always get celebrities out there because I mean I've got an issue of. It's not so much a comic, but I've got a comic of Eminem pairing up with the Punisher from a couple of years back, and then you know it's talk about celebrities. Celebrities are always in comics these days. I mean, look at President Obama showing up in the Marvel universe.
Yeah, yes. Well, that's different from what the topic that we're discussing today, and that's licensed.
No, right. I'm just saying, personalities do show up, right?
But one where it kind of blends all of that together is the Kiss comic series from IDW.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's based on a rock group and stuff. It's mm-hmm. within the last year or two. It's obviously licensed and stuff. So that's going off not really their personalities or personas, mm-hmm. but a very fictionalized, highly fictionalized version.
Right, but it's
Gene Simmons is involved in that comic too.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's based on the mythology of the group.
Right, but the group is a personality as a collective personality. So that would be a very contemporary example of, you know, what I brought up a second ago, and that is, you know, licensed personalities.
Mm-hmm. You know, this over the not the last weekend, but the weekend before, I was doing some stuff at this comic convention that they have in Columbia, South Carolina. It's a hip-hop and comic convention called ColaCon. And one of the panels I sat in on that was really interesting was different creators talking about doing comics featuring hip-hop artists. So one of them did. So Sanford Green was talking about doing the Method Man comic, and Damian Scott was talking about doing the DMC comic that's coming out right now. And that, you know, that these guys, these hip-hop artists kind of, especially, you know, by giving themselves these names and so on, kind of see themselves see the transition into being a comics character as being not that jarring, right? Very smooth. And that they were all comics fans growing up, and part of the way they've created their personas is through their understanding of comics.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't read any of those. I did read the Sentences graphic novel that went through Vertigo years ago, but that was more autobiographical.
Right.
But yeah, it's interesting how the rap music community has very much embraced comics in a lot of respects, mm-hmm. Both in terms of the artists and so forth.
And another thing, Andy, what you had just mentioned is interesting, and we can apply it to our larger discussion of licensed properties, and that is, I guess, the role of conventions that play a part in all of this, and I'm thinking not so much in terms of, or not only in terms of personalities, right? You'd mentioned earlier, you know, Ron Perlman, you know, linked to, you know, he's a big draw at these cons, you know, playing Hellboy, among other characters, but, you know, a lot of people are going to know him because of Hellboy, you know, and then we have the Hellboy comics, but you also have, you know, personalities from other media. Like, for instance, I think in John, isn't both Shatner and Nimoy, aren't they going to both be in Austin in a few weeks?
It's Shatner and Scott Bakula. So both of the first captains of the Enterprise.
Okay, so for some reason, okay, I thought Nimoy was going to be, I knew Bakula was. But here you have two these big personalities who are nonetheless linked to, you know, series that have, well, I was about to say strong, you know, strong or mediocre, depending on how you look at it, comic series based on the original. And so it'd be interesting, perhaps, to look at the way that conventions play along with, or maybe don't play into enough, this kind of linkage between the original medium, the film or the television show, and then the comics as a licensed property playing off of the original narrative.
Sorry, I got distracted. I was trying to figure out who had been in more comic book or had more of their shows in comic book format between Bakula and Shatner. Because Bakula had Quantum Leap turned mm-hmm. into a comic. Or not, yeah. He had, but it happened and he was involved in the show. Whereas Shatner had obviously the original Trek stuff and his Tech War stuff that he was actually involved in the comic side of.
Yeah. Was Hooker ever made into a comic?
Well, T.J. Hooker, I don't think was. Yeah. Something else with that name, who knows? Well,
that yeah, that's what I meant.
I know.
Yeah. Or maybe they could make a comic version of Emergency 911.
Oh, may have. Who knows? Jeez.
But this issue that I raised is interesting in that, or at least the cons that I've been to. Now, there are some that are going to be much more comic-centric, like, for instance, Heroes Con. But then there are others. I know that, you know, my local Dallas Con I've been to a number of times. And, I don't begrudge those who organize or those who attend the reasons for them going. I would say about at least 70% of the people who attend the Dallas Con go because of the TV and film personalities, and probably much more, a much higher percentage. And, you know, when you're in the, you know, artist alleys at the Dallas Con, it's relatively subdued. I mean, you'll find good crowds, but the vast majority of the people who attend the Dallas Con are going to be those who either want to see the big celebrities and or are really into the cosplay and not so much into the comic itself. And so I'm just wondering at what kind of potential, or maybe the lack thereof, that there are at some conventions where you have big media, television and film personalities and a lot of TV film stuff going on, you know, and then you have the comic side of things. Well, and they seem to be completely divorced, one from the other.
I wouldn't say completely divorced, but I would say you can take most conventions and split them into four sections. You've got the celebrity guests, you've got the artist alley, you've got the panels, and you've got the booths. I don't think most people go to a convention because, wow, I mean, there's a particular booth they want to go to. It's like, yeah, they're exhibitors and they'll buy stuff, don't get me wrong. I don't think most people go to a convention because there's a particular panel they want to go to. It may happen here or there. I think most people these days are going to a convention either because they're a fan of pop culture in general, comics or whatever, maybe specifically. But I think it really is those celebrity guests that drive a lot of people to these conventions.
Mm-hmm.
Last year here in Austin, they had the cast of The Next Generation. It drew a huge crowd. I would say most of the I'm saying a large contingent of the people, probably that was one of the deciding factors that pushed them over the edge and say, yeah, I'll go down to the convention center. This looks interesting.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny because I was talking with a friend of ours on the Comics Alternative, Andy Hirsch, who's actually local here. He lives right near me. I was talking with him the other day at our local shop, and we were talking about the Austin Con, in fact. And this is before we found out, John, that our panel was accepted. Mm-hmm. And And I said, yeah, maybe going down there. And he said he's not going to go anytime soon because he's had some bad experiences there. Now, he's an artist, and so he's always there in Artist Alley. He says that the last time that he was there, and if I'm remembering what he's told me correctly, he felt that the artists were kind of nudged to the side because of the celebrity aspect of the convention. And he just felt that they weren't given much space. They weren't given as much respect. And so he said he's not going to do that anytime soon. So he's not going to the Austin Con.
Well, I would say,
and I know that there's some cons, and I'm not just focusing on the Austin Con here, but I know that there are some examples, and I've seen this in the Dallas Con, you know, that seems to be a similar problem.
I would say that's nature of the beast with Wizard conventions. They do a you know, traveling roadshow kind of convention, and really a lot of what they're promoting is the celebrity guests.
Mm-hmm.
They'll promote the real heavy hitters on the comic side, you know, the Mark Bagleys, the Mike Grells. I'm trying to think of a few others like that. But your average run-of-the-mill comic artist, they get their little tiny table in Artist Alley compared to the bigger area. Even a actor who really hasn't done anything notable in the last 10, 20 years, I mean, they get a bit bigger and better space there, more prominent space. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I think what it comes down to, and part of why licensed comics tend to exist in general also, these properties in movies, television, and video games hit a huge, huge audience compared to what comic books get. So if you were a bit player in some, you know, genre TV show 10, 20 years ago, you're going to have a bigger draw than somebody who's a reasonably hot and popular comic artist today.
Mm-hmm.
One of the people who's going to be at the Austin convention is Jason David Franks. He was the Green Ranger among other, he was like the person who's played the most different Power Rangers and been in the most shows or whatever. I expect he's going to have a really big crowd or whatever during his appearance at the convention in Austin this time versus Mark Bagley, who did, what, 100 and how many issues of Ultimate Spider-Man in a row and has gone on to do many things before and did a lot of stuff since. I mean, big name artist.
Mm-hmm.
Most people aren't going to know who the hell he is, because to know that, you have to read comics, and the size of the comic audience, again, not that big compared to people who have heard of Power Rangers, who have watched TV over the last 20 years or what have you.
Yeah. Well, I guess one of the reasons why I brought up the whole convention thing is I'm curious about what kind of potential, if any, and there may be none there or not much there, of a convention being some kind of transition space to bring fans of one media to the kind of output in that within the same property, you know, introduce them more enthusiastically, I guess, to another media. So, for instance, you get a lot of people who may go to a convention who are big Doctor Who fans, right? I know just recently at the Dallas Con, oh God, the number of people who were there to see John Barrowman, and I was one of them because I was with my daughter. It was just ridiculously immense. And I stood in line, I think, for at least an hour and a half with my daughter to get his signature for my daughter. And, of course, she's salivating the entire time. But I just wonder how many of those fans of Torchwood, who is probably fans of Doctor Who, you know, they may know about the Doctor Who comic, but they may not have given it much of a chance. You know, maybe they have. I don't know. But I'm just wondering about the potential for a convention that, you know, crosses medium, right? You know, television, film, comics, what have you, as a way to bring fans from one medium closer to another medium. I don't know.
I think it's a great opportunity, and the people who are best able to leverage it, I think, are the artists. Because I think once somebody's gone into a convention, they're going to wander through Artist Alley and stuff like that. That's where somebody can really say, you know, hey, I worked on the Doctor Who comic, or I did this, or I did that, if they happen to have that right property, and they happen to know who the guests are going to be, and can push the right thing at the right time. Yeah, go ahead. You were going to say
anything? Do any of you, this just reminds me of something. Do any of you have experience either directly or anecdotally with one of these kind of property specific conventions? Like I'm thinking of like the G.I. Joe Con or the, you know, Buffyverse conventions, or I don't know, any other, I'm sure Doctor Who and Star Trek all have their own specific conventions as well.
I personally know, but my sister went to, I think it was a Firefly convention, and it was one of those on-again, off-again, is-it-going-to-happen type deals, and when she took off in the plane, it was on. By the time she landed, it was off, but enough people had gotten there that it was on again, sort of. It was kind of bizarre.
Because I've talked to the artist Jeremy Dale, who did some of his first work was in these comics that were packaged with G.I. Joe action figures. And so he's done JoeCon as an artist, and he said that the reception there is incredible now. It may be because those comics packaged with toys got this kind of crossover exposure, but the fans of the G.I. Joe toys are really welcoming of the artists.
Well, it seems like there you've got a built-in audience for the particular material you've got, versus at a regular convention, people are going for so many wildly different reasons that the odds of any particular artist or exhibitor having something that targets the majority of those people is kind of low.
Yeah, I guess this cycles back around to one of Derek's earlier questions. You know, if there are conventions devoted to Doctor Who and Star Trek, how prominent then are the comics at those conventions in order to generate that crossover exposure? You would think that that would be a perfect time to do that.
Certainly, if I were a license holder, or I would push the publisher to be at some of those types of conventions. Mm-hmm. If I were publishing comics of certain types, you know, Power Rangers has had a convention just for it, Power Morphicon or whatever. I don't know if Paper Cuts, the people who are doing the graphic novels for Power Rangers, show up there or not. They should. You know, I don't know if IDW tends to show up at a lot of the major Star Trek conventions or not. If not, they should. That just seems like preaching to the converted. And not, you don't necessarily have to have a huge presence there, but enough to let people know your comics exist. It seems like a really easy sales approach to take.
Well, you know, it would be nice, along with that, if the owners of the property would, at least with some of the properties, were more hands-on in terms of the cross-media aspect of their property. So, and I know, John, this is something that you and I have discussed at one point, can't remember when, but I know this has come up. And I think on that time that I helped you out early on.
When you were on the Mail Report, yeah.
Exactly, the Mail Report, is, you know, as you're watching Doctor Who, you do see commercials for Doctor Who toys. It would be interesting and useful, I think, for the comic, if the BBC also worked with IDW or with whomever to air commercials, and they wouldn't necessarily have to be commercials that are based solely on, let's say, the BBC America, you know, cable program. I mean, it could be even something a little more local, because I know our local shop has done something like that in the past with The Walking Dead, but just do something to help facilitate some kind of advertisement, some kind of marketing for the comic on air.
I question the viability of doing an actual commercial just because of the cost and the airtime, that kind of stuff. However, if I were going to do a licensed comic, I would certainly want a few things out of the license holder. A line in the credits saying, this is, you know, read more about it at this comic or whatever kind of a thing. Here's where to go. That the comic exists. Here's how to go find it. Something in DVD collections or on the DVD itself in the extras feature of just put a slide on the screen saying, yeah, we do comics. Here's where you can find them. Just something that's low cost and it may be low impact, but it's certainly more than they're getting now.
Yeah. Well,
if you look at if you look at the DVD extras for the Judge Dredd movie, they interviewed IDW for the Judge Dredd comics. So, you know, that's a nice piece of PR they could throw in.
Yeah. Well, okay, what I just referenced as an example, our local shop doing some commercials during The Walking Dead's season premiere. recently, and you know that locally my comic shop until recently has been Lone Star. Mm-hmm. And not only do they have, of course, now they're only mycomicshop.com, but you know, up until recently they did have quite a number of brick and mortar stores. They've sold all those brick and mortar stores off to others. Most of them have gone to, or well, a couple and maybe one or two others in the future, I don't know, have gone to a new company out of Fort Worth called Collected Comics, Games, and Gifts. And what they did as part of their launch out program, I guess, to let people know that they're there and they're a major force, or at least a growing force in the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex, is locally, with The Walking Dead, you know, that whole weekend before, even before the weekend, they had the, you know, the marathon that seemed to go on forever, leading up to the season premiere of The Walking Dead. Collected Comics bought airtime to advertise not just the fact that, yes, this is Collected Comics at these locations, but they also partnered, you know, not with Image, but with DC. And of the commercials that I saw, it was, at Collected Comics, you can find Fables, you know, the award-winning series. And I was asking one of the owners, whom I know, Brent Irwin, about how he you know, came up with that idea for that media campaign. And he said, it's something that we went half season with DC. He said, you know, they wanted to do this. We wanted to do it. They weren't advertising Walking Dead comics. They were advertising DC Vertigo Comics, you know, but during the time that the whole Walking Dead marathon and the season premiere was taking place. So I'm wondering, when you have big events like this, and of course, one of the reasons why we're doing this right now is because the 50th anniversary episode of Doctor Who, that special, is coming out in a few weeks from the time that we're recording this. It seems like there would be interesting potential there if there's some kind of similar partnering, you know, with maybe local shops, you know, owners of the franchise, the publishers, to get the word out about Doctor Who comics. And I can't help but think that other media phenomena, there's something similar that could go on.
I completely agree. I think it makes more financial sense for a local store to do that kind of advertising in their local area, certainly in partnership with the license holder and the publishers and such, than it does just for the license holder or the publisher to do it and kind of instigate it from their side. Mm. Just because simply the people walking into those stores based on the commercials they saw that you were talking about, whether they buy Fables, whether they buy other stuff, the one place that really is the recipient and the beneficiary of those commercials is that local store.
Right.
You know, I think it makes a lot of sense to do that. I personally have always thought that part of the contract negotiations for licensing, be either into comics or out of comics, in either direction, should be some sort of built-in mechanism for both parties to help get the word out about the stuff.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, there's no reason the BBC or BBC America shouldn't be pointing out, hey, there are comics based on this. You know, it's another revenue stream. It helps bridge the gap between season breaks and stuff. Keeps the property alive. Keeps the fans engaged and invested. Where's the harm in that?
Exactly. One medium can generate interest in the other.
Yeah.
Or continued or sustained interest. Yeah. Well, you know, I'm curious to know, we've been talking about a number of different aspects or facets of licensed comics. And as I think I told you guys before we started to record, that, you know, you, the three of you, have more experience with licensed properties within comics than I do. It's not that I've read as many, especially growing up. I read more now than I did when I was younger. So let me ask you guys this. Of, you know, looking at the entire history, you're reading your comic book reading history, you know, what is your favorite, or what are some of your favorite licensed properties? You know, the ones that thrilled you the most, the ones that you think were best executed?
That's a great question. I'm going to need to think about that for a minute.
I can go then.
Yeah.
We've already talked about mine, so... But to kind of elaborate, it's those Marvel licensed comics from the mid to late 70s that included, starting basically with Star Wars and then going into Micronauts and Shogun Warriors and Ram and Godzilla, that especially with both Micronauts and ROM, which were both written by Bill Mantlow. Mantlow kind of took what were kind of lackluster properties and built a whole mythology around them that was satisfying on its own, and it didn't even depend on owning the toys. In fact, I had Micronauts toys when I was a kid, but there was very little overlap between those toys and what was going on in the comics. The character called Time Traveler was the primary action figure, but he featured very limitedly into the comic. So Mantlow seemed to be able to just take those, what was kind of basically interesting to him, and create really interesting storylines around them that transcended the fact that they were licensed comics. So those were my favorites.
Okay. Chris, what about you?
Well, I think it's kind of fun to see the progression of Star Trek through the years. You know, with the old Gold Key comics, that was, 60 issues or something like that. And then just to see how I'm reading the newspaper strips now that just came out in the two-volume set from IDW. And of course, the DC run, the Marvel run, and how they, you know, do adaptations of the movie properties and what IDW is doing, not only with the new Star Trek, but also they're producing, you know, the Doctor Who Star Trek stuff for the Legion Star Trek crossover just from a couple years ago. And, you know, the Star Trek universe is so vast, and it's just kind of fun to see how they take it in all the different angles and how everything kind of, you know, the puzzle is huge, but yet somehow it fits. And if I can just talk real quick about the Godzilla series, I picked that up when it came out in the Essential form a couple years ago, thinking that it was only going to be a monster Godzilla series. I had no idea it was primarily a S.H.I.E.L.D. book.
Right.
And that's what was really, really cool to me, that, you know, Dum Dum Dugan and everybody was in on this, watching Godzilla trek across not only the United States, but back into Japan and then to Alaska and then back into America. It was really kind of fun to see that. So I really, really enjoyed that story.
Yeah, you talked that up enough that I have gone and gotten that Essential Godzilla. I haven't read it yet, but it does sound like a lot of fun. I'm going to have to go with the Star Trek stuff, too, because, you know, I've been reading licensed comics of one form or another for decades, and there have been some high and low points for the Star Trek stuff, but it's usually been very good, very true to the series. I'm really loving what IDW is doing with it right now. I think Chris really hit the nail on the head. It's not only is the ongoing series so great, but seeing it cross over the Star Trek property with the Legion of Superheroes, with Doctor Who, stuff like that, it's just a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
So how about you, Derek?
Yeah, well, you know, as I said, I don't have near as much experience, and so my, like, quote-unquote favorites are probably going to be a little more pedestrian. But, you know, if we expand our understanding of licensed comics in ways that I think, John, you were defining at the beginning when you were going through the different kinds, you know, I'd have to say that the Manifestations of the Spirit probably are some of my favorites. So I would fall down there. Although, you know, Chris, when you had mentioned Godzilla, that reminded me of some of the collections that Craig Yeoh has come out with this year, you know, earlier back in February, you know, the Ditko Monster series, you know, the Gorgo, and then just the other week or last month, Konga. And so, you know, I've been reading through the Gorgo collection, and it really is fun. And again, I just mentioned this not as one of my favorites, but that, you know, your mentioning of Godzilla reminded me of something that I hadn't thought of, and that is these Ditko Monster series that Yo's been putting out.
I was hanging out with Craig Yeoh just last Saturday. He was up here for the Detroit Fan Fair, speaking of small conventions. So,
wow.
It was a good time. Craig was. It was finally I had the chance to meet him face to face, and he was a lot quieter than I thought he would be. A really, really quiet guy, but an interesting guy. A lot of fun.
Yeah, you know, Andy and I are going to be talking with him soon. I can't be any more specific than that because In fact, maybe now that we talk about this, I'll try to remember to call him after we finish recording. He was supposed to be on an episode of the Comics Alternative, but there was some technical problems and he wasn't able to join us. And so we said, well, let's set up another time for us to get together. And he's up for it, but he's been traveling recently. And he said, call and leave a message. So I just need to get back with him on that. So I haven't met him.
Yeah, he's a great guy. Definitely have him on the show. There's so much to talk about. I mean, you know, he's the guy. Him and Blake Bell are the guys to talk about when it comes to Ditko. Mm. So, you know, and speaking of licensed properties, Ditko did the GoBots way back when, if you guys remember that. and Chuck Norris. I think he worked on Chuck Norris, too.
Yeah, so. Yes, he did. He did the last few he did the last few issues of ROM, too.
He did, yes, that's right.
And in fact, there's a big crowd scene in, I think, the very last issue that has Spider-Man in the background, and apparently in the original art, he didn't draw Spider-Man. He just had told the inker to fill that in.
Oh, cool.
So the question I have is kind of a follow-up to Derek's. What would be kind of your dream project or whatever in terms of a licensed comic? What would you like to see done?
Hmm. Well, I've already mentioned a Rockford file.
Yeah, I think that'd be a great one. I'd do that as a period piece. I could definitely see that working.
I think I've had it in that, you know, on top of the ones I've said, I think that Howard Chaykin's Shadow series is also one of my favorites. And having Chaykin do a Shadow series, and I think he's about to do another one for Dynamite, is, I think, is a good match of a creator and a property.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Chris?
I have no idea. I mean, I'm going off TV shows. The top of my head, I'm like thinking of Miami Vice, but I'm like, no, that wouldn't really work out. I don't know. I mean, maybe something cool in the vein of the Universal Monsters, something like that, going way back when, and doing like adaptations of Lon Chaney or something like that as a Wolfman would be kind of cool. But, you know. Part of me thinks they've probably done that over the years.
If not, they should have.
Yeah, yeah.
How about you, John?
I would like to see the Toei company that does the Super Sentai shows branch out, do a comic version, and do it as, you know, maybe not a very manga-styled visually type thing, but something that's comes out weekly and is told as if it were one of their weekly 52 episode type shows. That's something that I think in the US market could do fairly decently. Of course, by decently, we've looked at low sales, so 10,000 could be decent. Mm-hmm. It's something that I think would be fun to do.
And the potential there would be getting the manga fan, because, you know, manga sells in ways that, you know, let's say American style comics do not.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, and I think it's something that lends itself to a weekly frequency, and I think that can do a lot towards story momentum and keeping readers engaged.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've covered a lot of ground with the topic of licensed comics, and, you know, it, of course, this is, you know, it's a topic without a bottom. We can continue going on about this, and there's a lot to discuss. But I think it's been a very fruitful conversation, and now I think what the four of us need to do is to think about what topic we may want to discuss on our next roundtable.
Sounds like a plan.
Mm-hmm. Or dig into that Godzilla Essentials collection, which is probably what I'm going to do. You guys decide what the next topic's going to be. I'm reading some Herb Trimpe Godzilla right now.
And with that, thank you guys. I've had a good time.
Cool.
Thanks. Thank you.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.